Ready to go? Okay, so this is our workshop on the Party Communist Revolutionary, Revolutionary Communist Party of Canada. And this is Gabriella, who's representing the Revolutionary Communist Party of Canada. So she's going to give a talk, and then we'll have a question and answer session about the group and its perspective.
Okay, we're going to print it after because there's other stuff in it.
So. Okay, oh, I see. All right.
Yeah.
Yes, that's fine.
Yeah. Well, thank you. So please, you'll apologize with my accent and my English speaking, which is not necessarily perfect. It's going to be a little of a challenge to try to present you briefly what is RCP Canada. I will try to give you an overview of the way we have developed as an organization, because it has been pretty, I would say, different from the other ML groups or Maoist groups. So maybe that's going to give you also a good portrait of how did we arrive to the conclusion of, you know, creating a party in 2007, because at the time, at the beginning, that was not necessarily the case. So in 1986, there was a group that has been formed that was called Action Socialiste. So Action Socialiste was really coming from young radicals and young students from a Montreal university. And the general political context in 1986 was not necessarily favorable for that kind of group to exist or to emerge. Actually, we were at a moment where the ML existing group were, and I'm talking mostly in Quebec at the time, but there was two major ML organizations, pretty important, pretty significant, the Workers' Communist Party and the group En Lutte. And they have just collapsed a few years before, in the midst of, I could say, the return of the capitalist role in China and all of that, that brought really a major crisis, not only in the ML groups in Quebec, but throughout the world. Actually, that has been a moment of serious difficulties, let's say, to overcome that development. So the members of Action Socialiste were not at all coming from those movements and from that history. They were just young radicals, not necessarily familiar with the Marxist ideology, although they knew about it, of course. But they were on a different model, let's say. The model was, of course, radicalism, and their perspective was to radicalize the struggles and make them more, affirmative in front, not only of capitalism, but mostly at the time it was a struggle to maintain the independence of the student movement from the state. Because at the time in Quebec, it was the PQ, which was the nationalist party that was in power, and they really had a corporatist approach of trying to, you know, bring this idea, well, of course, of the independence of Quebec. And to that respect, they were really trying to co-opt, in a way, the student movement to make them part of that big nationalist movement. And at the time, Action Socialiste was very critical of that that co-optation with the state, and because they were already questioning the essence of that state, so already there was that defiance of putting the state at the same level of the capitalism, and they were playing a role in capitalism. So just to give you an overview, Action Socialiste lasts from 1986 to 2000. So it's pretty interesting to see that today, you know, there was this question on the plenary that we'll have tonight about the left in the 2000s. And interestingly for us, 2000s really marked the first step towards a, you know, a different strategy of development for us. So from 1986 to 2000. In 2000, we transformed to what we have called the organizing committee of the Revolutionary Communist Party. So we were bringing this new perspective that there was a necessity to create a party, and not any kind of party, but a Revolutionary Communist Party. So that was a way for us to distinguish ourselves from the former Communist Party experience. And at the time, we didn't have any awareness of... We knew about the RCP USA, but for us, it was not related to their own experience and their own... It was really something very, you know, different. And finally, in 2007, the organizing committee of the RCP, organized a congress, and that's where we've transformed to the RCP Canada. So we can say that this is something that was against the current, let's say, as what we have seen over the last 10 years, let's say, is more this idea of the party not being, you know, the way of achieving, well, exactly what we don't know, but still, I think there is a confusion about the goal. There is a major confusion about the strategy to reach that goal. And in that respect, we think that the creation of a revolutionary party was one step towards trying to address those issues and trying to make those social movements that we have seen growing over the years to go through a new step of organization. Because at the very beginning, Action Socialiste was mainly, you know, an organization that was totally activist, I would say ultra activist in the mass, in the different mass struggles, whether it be the student movement, but also the women's movement. There has been a very important struggle for the right to abortion during the 80s, the end of the 80s in Quebec, and we've been very active in the women's movement at that time. Same in the in the student movement, and also in the workers movement, because at some point some former ML individually rallied our organization. So we have developed a very consistent practice and experiences in those movements. So we were really good at organizing demos and, you know, bringing people to be there and agitate with some watchwords and all that stuff. But as time was going by, I mean, where does that lead us to? Was there a development, a political development for moving forward revolution and moving forward socialism? And we didn't necessarily, see that there was, good steps that were moving in. So when we have learned about what was happening in Peru and the people's war that was there, it has been for us a very important political moment and a political experience that we really needed to grasp and to understand, because it was there an attempt to make a revolution. And I would say it was the first practical experience of trying to do a revolution since a long time. So for us, it really worth the... it was important that we learned about this. So that's where we have been getting closer to Maoism and to understanding what was exactly Maoism, so the Chinese experience and what was happening in Peru. So this has been a moment where we've became Maoist. because of that experience. And what we've tried to do is not only we were adopting Maoism not only in terms of a winning strategy for revolution, and I will talk about that later, because for us, people's war as a strategy is clearly the most promising avenue to which we should look if we want to make revolution in a capitalist country today. So there's that aspect of Maoism that we were totally, I would say, curious to know more about. There was also this idea of revolution after the revolution, so the necessity to continue the process, because otherwise, I mean, you know, the capitalist road is never very, very far. And there was also the, I would call that the Maoist attitude, but it's probably all this idea of how to make unity. What is the process towards different organizations and different movements to be able to progress towards a political unity? And we've been very bad at that in the first years of our organizations. I mean, we were doing discussions, but it always ended with a split or with people leaving the organization, which we didn't know how to do it properly and to do it only in political terms and not only like... So this is an apprentissage.
Learning.
This is a learning process. I mean, it's not something that you can know how to do the first... Like when you're a young organization, it's like normal to not being able to do it properly and to... Unfortunately, you lose people by you know, doing it that way. So this is another portion of Maoism that we've tried to grasp, was how to do a correct political struggle, not only among ourselves as an organization, but also with anarchists and with other groups that we were in the struggles working with pretty frequently. So, and I think that we have recognized at that period of time, I would say at the end of the 90s, that the anarchist movement has been able to clearly break with what I would call revisionism from the communist, from most of the Communist Party, who have really felt into... the legal bourgeois framework, and they were only understanding the work of the communists as being routine and simply being waging your flag and showing the figures of a so I think that one of the positive the positive addition coming from the anarchist movement was certainly to show that we need to break with legality and to break with that legal understanding that we have, that the struggle cannot go, is always within the parameters of what the bourgeoisie is imposing to us. So I think that was important historically at that moment, and that we must recognize that. But still, over the course of that, we also learned to understand the limits of refusing to organize in a more long-term mode, let's say, and in a more strategic mode. So the limit of anarchism as a mode of, you know, as a strategy to move towards revolution. But I think that it's because of Maoism that we've been able to understand that, to understand what they brought to the movement and how to make a good discussion with them and a good struggle politically with them. So the reality is that today we can work on several struggles, you know, with them in a sort of a united front, but still we have our own, you know, disagreement or whatever, but it doesn't prevent us at least to have a mutual respect in the way that we are working and to make a difference between unity in struggle, in the struggle, and political unity for, you know, a long-term project, which is different. And so that was part of the process, I think, for us to integrate what is the, what we consider the principles, the main principles of Maoism. So at the end of the 2000s, we had a program where we were clearly standing what we, you know, what we're struggling for. And we decided to make a struggle for creating a party. And certainly this has brought a lot of discussions around the idea of a party, what it is exactly, because the conceptions we have is pretty mechanic of what is a party, and for people it's like a bourgeois party. You know, they see it or they understand it in the same type of frame, and for us it was important to bring back this idea that a revolution, a proletarian party, a revolutionary party, is something necessarily different, not only in terms of how it organized itself, but also what is bringing to the masses and how we want to have, what is the link between a party and between the masses. So there was a big discussion about, yeah, but it's not time to create a party, we're not enough people, and you know, it was all this mechanical understanding of what it takes to create a party. And actually the focus we had was rather to see it as a kind of ideological and political offensive in the general political struggle against bourgeoisie, to reaffirm the necessity for the working class, for the proletariat, for the most exploited masses to gather together and to organize. So it was a way, so for us it was, if we create the party, then it will bring, I mean, you know, people to join it, because if you don't have it, why people would join? So it was, there was a very important discussion and struggle around that objective of creating a revolutionary party. And actually, I can say that I think that we were right at the end. I mean, that was a good decision, because actually it brought a visibility to Maoism in Canada. It brought a perspective, a revolutionary, an organized perspective, you know, in Canada for, you know, moving forward revolution, not only as being a vague and confused idea that will happen in the very late future, but rather to see, okay, how to today in 2010 now, or 2012, how can we reach that goal from day one, which is today, when we start from nothing, basically, and how can we accumulate and be able to work for, you know, having revolution and have to happen in a capitalist country like Canada. And I guess the challenge is, of course, the same in the US. So that was a little bit the conclusion of that thinking. The other aspect that has been pretty major is that we were mainly Quebec-based for most of our existence. We had few contacts in the rest of Canada, but there was that barrier of language that is pretty, as you know, important, because it's okay to bring your own newspaper and propaganda, and we were doing desperate efforts to have bilingual stuff and English stuff, but it was not happening. So again, although we had contacts in the rest of Canada, we decided to organize in Toronto a second revolutionary congress in which we were calling the people, the individual in the rest of Canada to manifest themselves and to be visible and to participate, so we can have that exchange and that discussion to see if they were sharing the same perspective than we were. So we produced a document called The Proletarian Movement We Need, and it was a little bit the way of relaunching this discussion about what is the class struggle in Canada, what does that mean, and how can we make it more lively, and what kind of organizations we need, what kind of struggles we need. Because yes, there is the party, but there's also the masses that are in movement, that are struggling, and how do we understand, how do we make the link with them? So we launched that document and invited people from the rest of Canada to participate to that conference that happened in 2010, and we were bringing the perspective of creating wherever there was revolutionaries and you know honest communist individuals who were aiming of in working for a revolution to create what we were calling Proletarian Revolutionary Action Committee. So it was not necessarily being part of the party, but it was creating at least a form of a committee to unite those forces together and to start the discussions with around the struggle, but around some different political campaigns also that we wanted to bring. So basically, at the Congress, we have brought different proposals. One was to create those PRAC, let's call it that way, to gather around also a boycott campaign, because there was a federal election to come pretty shortly after our Congress, and we were trying to push that. We were saying that the first effects of the new class struggle, of the first statement we need to make in front of the bourgeoisie and in front of that famous legal bourgeois framework where everybody is think that by voting they are exercising democracy, we say let's take that opportunity to bring this idea of what is the democracy we want to have. And by launching this boycott campaign watchword, it brought, really, it was very shaking and shocking for a lot of, you know, the usual left groups that were, for some of them, pretty shocked by the fact that we were actively calling people not to go to vote. And we were saying, well, are we for that kind of bourgeois democracy, that kind of parliament? Do we think that's the way we will be closer to revolution? Or should we break with that kind of democracy and should we say it? So the Congress adopted as well that campaign, and it has been, I think, pretty successful in bringing a totally different discussion in the left among that, and really showed clearly where was the line of demarcation between those who talk about revolution, but in fact are only understanding their politics to be within this, you know, bourgeois legality, and those who were willing to break with that, because we think it's the first step too. So it's kind of an ideological, but also a political struggle. So not being in the ideological discussion, we need to be in the politics, we need to be present in the day-to-day struggle and issues that are brought to the masses every day and that they have to work around. So the other element of that was adopted at that Congress was to create and to invite as much people as possible to participate, to create a bilingual and nationwide newspaper, because we didn't at that time, and that's where we have been able to organize with people that were not member of the RCP, but and people that were member. That Partisan newspaper that is now being issued every 2 weeks in French and English, and that we are trying to distribute Now it's mainly Ontario and Quebec, but we have few points of distribution in the rest of Canada. But still, that was a major step that happened because of that initiative that we have to create the Congress in Toronto. And there was also this necessity of discussing and to support the people's war experience that are right now happening or being developed in the rest of the world, and to understand the dangers that they are facing, but also the positive developments that it had allowed in some part of the world, like in India, for example, and in Nepal, of course. So there was this necessity also to link our own struggle with what was happening in the rest of the world. And there was also this call to support the struggles of the Native nations in Canada. That aspect will certainly be at the forefront of the political life in Canada over the years to come, because basically of this, the way that now the imperialist, the Canadian industry, mostly in mining and in natural resources, is now all the economy in Canada now has been moving from manufacturers and now more those sectors now is really moving aggressively into the mining industry and the mining sector, and the Canadian companies have been very aggressive in developing and over the few years. Not only in Canada, but in the rest of the world as well. So they are very. It's very important that we focus on how they do develop. And in Canada, of course, like in the rest of the world, most of the sectors or the territories where they want to do exploration and is of course territories that belongs to the Native nations. So that's going to be crucial over the years to come, that we connect with the Native nations and with their struggle, if we want to be consistent with the strategy of making revolution in Canada will certainly happen only if we succeed by doing that connection with the Native peoples. So that was also part of the perspective we were putting forward. And I would say the last thing we are working on is, I was talking to you about the necessity of defining a strategy for revolution, like the how to go towards the revolution. And for us, it's the key issue of the revolutionary movements in all the capitalist countries today, is trying to solve that issue and that problem of finding how we will, you know, be able to move towards that strategy and that revolution. So we've been working for 2 or 3 years for publishing a consistent book that will talk about people's war in Canada, but more the general idea of why we think that people's war is universal, why we think people's war is not about military issues. It's all about political, development, and it's a political strategy. But there is also that aspect of the armed struggle, of course, that is part of it, but it's most and foremost a political strategy. So that's going to be, for us, if we succeed in finally achieving that goal of publishing that book, we think it's going to, we hope that it's going to bring, an important discussion, certainly in Canada and hopefully at the international level as well, among the revolutionary movements that are part of a capitalist country, in finding how we will you know, a break with the old conceptions of just there's going to be a big night and, you know, from one day to another, it's going to be a revolution. That's not true. It's not going to happen that way. So how do we build from today, from day one, so let's say from almost zero, to, you know, having a movement that will be in a position to overthrow capitalism and overthrow the bourgeoisie that is in power. So that's huge, that's totally crazy, but it needs to be done. It needs to, and certainly it's the questions that need to be solved. It's the question of the strategy for revolution. So of course, this strategy for us need to be grounded in the historical experience that has been done by the proletariat and by the revolutionary movement and by the communists over the last more than 100 years. So we cannot ignore that. We cannot say, okay, let's erase all of that and let's start from nothing. No, we have things to learn from that, good and bad things to learn from that past experience, but we need to integrate it. So, and maybe that's why when I was thinking about the beginning of Action Socialiste, where we were just, you know, it took us like 20 years and more than 20 years to 20 years of experience, 20 years of practice, 20 years of mistakes, 20 years of, you know, experience in the real life to arrive, to conclude that, you know, this question of a party is a necessity, and that the question of a strategy for a revolution is a necessity. So I think that this question needs to be at the heart of the left movement of today. Because when we see what's happening with Occupy and with, there are very positive and important things that we can learn from those experiences. In terms an experience of another type of democracy, an experience of how things could work on another society. So there's things to learn from that. But at the same time, we see also the limit of, you know, the spontaneous movement and how it reached a point where you cannot, within the framework of capitalism, you know, stay in a park for 100 years. I mean, you know, that cannot work. So there's other questions that it brings. And I think that we need to again, accumulate that new experience and integrate it in, you know, what we have to do in the future. So it was pretty it was a little bit back and forth in the presentation, but I've tried just to give you a sense. Yes, very quickly. So that's it.
Okay, thank you. So we're going to take questions in groups of threes, and then you can address them as you see fit. Okay. So, any questions?
Hi, I'm Brian Whaley. I'm a member of Platypus. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit more about People's War. One of the, I guess, problems that I have with the concept of the people is that it's an abstraction, and it leaves out what it abstracts from is what makes up the people exactly, what their sort of class ideological or national sort of basis is. And I think in a lot of people's wars, what happens is that, you know, they can fizzle out or can end up having effects in which originally weren't intended, precisely because they sort of leave aside in this attempt of unity exactly what makes up the people. So could you talk a little bit about how you see the RCP or a revolutionary party orienting itself towards the people's war with, you know, how it is that you think you can assert or sort of lead or assert leadership and sort of guide the people's war to, I guess, prevent or overcome sort of the obstacles that the sort of people's war itself presents.
Next up.
Yeah, I have a question as well. I guess the thing that I'm kind of interested in was this, the latter part of the talk in terms of trying to draw lessons from the past. And it was interesting to me, and this is my impression, is that as a group, it has this almost latter-day introduction to Maoism, although in Quebec there is this strong experience of the new communist movement in the 70s, which you didn't draw as sort of like a thread into this group. So I wondered like what lessons were drawn from the new communist movement, because it seemed like the unity conferences of Alut have some similarity, or maybe they don't. There's like a way in which there seems to be some things to draw. The way that you described the new communist movement falling apart is externally. There was the trauma of China. I'd like to hear you flesh out a little bit more about why that movement failed and how the other thing was this idea of the Mao sensibility being sort of centered around creating unity, finding a basis for creating unity, which seems like, it seems in some ways an advance beyond the new communist movement, which seemed to be very exclusionary, like making this kind of this very successful growth with the RCP, with working with anarchists in Montreal, seems very different from what the new communist movement would have attempted in the 70s, for example. So I'd just like to hear you talk a little bit more about that. And it strikes me that the RCP is a very unique group in Canada. Like, it came out during the boycott of the election, where every left group was, with the specter of Harper, everybody sort of got into the elections. It didn't matter if you were an anarchist or whatever. And there was a line, there was a way in which you distinguished yourself. So I'd like to see how you understand that more clearly, stemming back to the revolution, at the new communist movement in the 70s. What was learned, and how you're really consciously moving beyond that past?
Mike?
Yeah, I thought the last two questions were really interesting. So some of the things I would ask. I had two things to add. I was interested in this distinction you made between attracting people's war as a political strategy and its existence as a military strategy. Previously, Maoists have had a view of political strategy being formed of united front against imperialism or the Three Mountains in China. And then my understanding, protracted people's war being the form that the military struggle took in that political context. You seem to be presenting a somewhat different view, or perhaps I misunderstood that. And then historically in Canada, one of the sharp demarcations within the political left is how we view the class nature of the ruling classes, whether Canada is a dominated country or an imperialist country, whether the Quebec bourgeoisie is part of an oppressed nation in the main, or is itself an imperialist nation, and obviously sort of there's a major historical and political question about the future existence of a multinational Canada, the possibilities of independence for Quebec, and then also for the First Nations. So I that's a lot, but if you just sort of sketch your views on that, that'd be interesting.
Okay, I'll try not to forget. So let's start with the how we see the people's war and the question of class in it. I think that the first thing that needs to be done in any country, if you are a revolutionary party, is to make the class analysis of the country you are, you know, living in. So in Canada, this is something that we are in the process of doing, is trying, what are the different classes, and what is the bourgeoisie exactly? And contrary to Occupy movement, who has that slogan of one person against 99, I guess it's, unfortunately, it's not exactly that. The bourgeoisie is now gathering around itself far more than 1% of the population. So this has to be clarified and have to, so in that class analysis, we need to understand what are the stratas that are today the most willing to do revolution or to fight against capitalism. So these are the ones that we should focus on as a first step, you know, to form the nucleus of the struggle and of the movement. And certainly we should consider now that there is a very important strata of the upper working class, but I would say more the union and bureaucratic strata of the working class, that unfortunately today is now an ally of the bourgeoisie and of capitalism as a system. Now they have some actions in big companies. They are acting in many ways as they were themselves, you know, and investors in companies. And because of that, it really brought this ideologically, it's very strong what they have been able to integrate ideologically in the working class, the idea that we can be part of the capitalism and we can have our own share of the pie. So the first thing is certainly to have a clear understanding of the class portrait in Canada. The first thing we can say is certainly that the core of the working class or of the proletariat or of the most exploited people is the immigrants, the natives, are certainly the one that we should put in the very, it's maybe like 60% of the population that is today a potential for revolution. So these are the ones we should focus on first. And this is why at some points, historically, we were pretty active in the union movements, but at some points we realized that it was not necessarily the place where we were to be. And it brought a real proletarization of our organization, because we used to be students and all that stuff. Now the main composition of our party, and it brings other difficulties. There's an important portion of young, poor, exploited people that are not necessarily petit bourgeois at all, so they have unstable conditions of life, and this is a challenge when you are doing politics to have them to be able to be active politically, because they are very often struck in their own difficulties. So, but at the same time, it brought us a new quality in terms of will for revolution and radicalism, and we need to keep certainly that aspect. So I think it's correct to make that first that class analysis and be sure that, you know, let's concentrate on those 60%, and let's be aware that it's not the time now to try to convince, you know, the upper little bourgeoisie of the necessity of the revolution. We need first to gain this core mass of people that won't be opportunistic, or we hope will not have that facility to fall into opportunism or to fall into those dangers that any movement will encounter. I mean, it's not scientific. There will always be a danger for any movement to fall into opportunism and to give up with revolution. I mean, you cannot protect yourself from that danger, but you can create conditions to make it harder to win within a party or within an organization. So this, certainly there is a class perspective in what we understand as being people's war. Is the core of the revolution will be those 60% of peoples, and so these are the ones we need to win politically, ideologically, if we want to hope today that the mass movement and the mobilization will be able to do a revolution, because you cannot make a revolution if you don't have the majority with you. Even if this majority is small, but at the first, when you want to launch, you know, the more armed struggle aspect of a war, if you don't have that majority, forget it; it won't happen. So it's not about adventurism. It's not about launching, you know, military and armed struggle when you are like marginalized. I mean, it won't happen. And maybe this is. One thing that is important to look at, the experience of the far left and guerrilla movement in urban and capitalist countries in Europe This experience is very important to look at and to consider, because there was positive aspect against in what they've tried to do, but there was also aspect that needs to be addressed so we don't repeat their mistakes. Should I finish and then I'll take your question, if you don't mind?
Yeah, I think that's probably
Yeah, if you don't mind, because
we'll probably have time for one quick round of questions, I think.
So I can go further, but that was the start of an answer. What was the lessons that we've learned from the experience of the communist movement in Quebec in the 70s? Certainly trying to understand why they collapsed. And it was a mixed of, yes, a political crisis at the international level. But there was also nationalism in Quebec that was very strong, because the class struggle was pretty active and big during the 70s in Quebec, and that brought the PQ, which was a nationalist bourgeois party, to be put in power, and that has very negative effects on the far left, as they were not able to demark themselves from that nationalism. So that partly brought some of them to leave and to join the nationalist movement at the time. And I guess there was a lot of economism also in those organizations, as they were very good at organizing in the unions, in all those sectors, but not necessarily to bring in communist perspectives. And the other aspect is that they thought really, because it was many petit bourgeois members at the time, many in those parties, and they were, I think that they were really believing that revolution was to happen in the years in front of them, because of that, class struggle that was strong. But at the same time, they had no idea on how it would happen, and they never asked themselves about that. So I think that the development of the social movements also had an effect, a bad effect on them. And because they were dogmatic in part, people didn't continue with them. So, yeah, that's a very short explanation that I can say.
I'm sorry, I think we've got to wrap it up now.
I just want a clarification. I guess I'm a little confused by this term, people's war. And I'm not, because it seems to be used in many different ways. I remember... it seems common for Maoists to call for people's war. The image that I have is it's some kind of guerrilla struggle, but sometimes I don't understand what's meant. For example, I remember there was a headline in the RCP in the U.S. was calling for people's war in Palestine. And I didn't know I understand the concept of armed struggle, but it seemed to be calling for some kind of guerrilla warfare, and my sense was, the terrain of the type of struggle that would exist in some other country, it's not something that could be carried out. And when you say a people's war in Canada or North America, I just sort of wonder, like either you're just talking about some kind of militant political struggle, building like a radical political movement, and then I sort of wonder why you use the term people's war, or you mean something that is more militarized, which would be like urban guerrilla warfare. And then I wonder why.
Well, maybe I'm going to answer both your questions and yours about how we understand people's war. I will try to do it in 2 minutes, but we can have a further discussion.
The Marxist unionists can wait.
First, when we refer to people's war, certainly we do refer to the experience of the people's war in China and the experience of revolution in China, and how does that movement have happened. So first is to study that specific experience that has happened in a third world country, let's say, or an oppressed country at the time. So first it was an anti-imperialist, you know, component. The anti-imperialist component was, of course, principal in the struggle. Our hypothesis or our first assessment in developing the strategy of peoples who are in a capitalist country is that in most of the oppressed country, the military struggle is principal right at the start. While in a capitalist country, the military struggle is not principal at the start. What is principal at the start is the ideological and political struggle that will bring us to that. And but it's still there. So
you're saying that sometime down the road you now see that political struggle will entail guerrilla warfare?
Yes, is
that sort of the vision? I'm just trying to clarify what the
Well, vision. We don't want to make, like, we don't want to oppose political and military. For us, there is the experience of illegality that needs to happen right now. We need to be able to understand what is doing things that are not legal within the bourgeois framework. Now we don't have that experience. We make a clear cut. Most of the groups are making a clear cut between the armed struggle being very far and the political struggle. We think that you cannot from one day to another pass from political to military or armed struggle. So we need to understand what is the dialectical of it. And I will say that the understanding of people's war, and Mao was not only bringing their military strategy. If you read what is exactly like, even his military writings, it's not about military. Yes, there is that aspect, but he's very consistent on how to understand the political landscape and the political situation in a country like China. Where are the weakness of the bourgeoisie? Where are his force? So, yeah, it's too much.